while and listen.
Cowabunga!
It's good!
Why'd you have to go and make things so complicated? I see the way you're acting like somebody else, and honestly, it gets me frustrated.
Frustrated.
Right. You
for
know,
once,
you
I know
what I'm. You
for
know what
once,
I'm saying.
I know.
For once,
I almost never know.
No, that's not true. Like 2-3 episodes, you're like, "What the fuck is this guy talking about?" But
well,
but
you didn't warn me.
I would say a good 60 to 65 episodes, you were right there with me, lockstep. Every reference, every commercial, every serial. You know, we were good. Welcome. To Colette and Matt have entered the chat, a proud member of the HyperX Podcast Network. I am, let's say 49% of that equation. Matt Silverman here, joined as always by the titular co-host, Colette Bennett. Hello.
Why do I get 51% and you only
You know,
what's that about?
Maybe it's a gender thing. You know, like there's more ladies in this world statistically. So
look at you. Wow.
I'm gonna give it to you.
Well, thank you. Hello.
How have you been?
I am pretty good, actually. I had the indulgent experience over the weekend of literally playing games all of Saturday and most of Sunday. Things to say.
Yes, you were gearing up for a rainy sort of post-hurricane.
Yeah,
whatever
it was rainy
going on.
And my husband had friend plans on Saturday, which I was invited to but declined because I was like, video games. And then Sunday he had a class. So I was like, oh my God, I really am like not alone that often. I'm gonna do this. And man, it was rad. So I will save that for the what have we been playing portion of the show.
Save it because
I highly recommend this to anyone who's like, man, you know, I haven't done that in a long time. Like you're just getting like an hour in here, an hour in there. Just indulge a whole weekend or like a whole day. Just do it. Feels great.
It is, I don't know, a hashtag adulthood, I suppose, but it feels like a thing that is lifetimes ago of I literally, truly, utterly have nothing better to do than to go hard on this particular game because there's no commitments. I'm sure I've mentioned this on the show, but a colleague of mine who actually remains in the games press, I believe, but like, I mean, and we just crossed the threshold here. It was Skyrim coming out 11/11/11. This is 2011, November 11th, of course. And he's like, yeah, I'm going to take a vacation. I'm going to take a week off. Like, I'm going to take some PTO. I was like, oh, where are you going? Nowhere. I'm just going to get a bunch of snacks and get into Skyrim for a week straight and not
Hell yeah.
and do nothing else. I was like, respect.
I've said on this show before that that's what I used to do when Final Fantasy main entries came out.
Yeah.
And for many years until Square Enix became a thing. And then I was like, what the fuck? But before that.
Before that, a simpler time. Well, the things that you had queued up last week and the things that you were continuing to play, I am very eager to hear about that. Mm-hmm. But we have a lot of ground to cover. We cannot talk about that right now because...
Agent Mulder believes we are not alone.
We are not alone. Okay. This is a very special episode. We are pleased, thrilled to welcome an old friend, an old colleague of mine, and a new guest on this show. Jeff Petriello is a producer at New York Times. Perhaps you've heard of them. New York Times Games, and also an adjunct faculty member at NYU, where he teaches game design. Jeff Petriello, welcome to the chat.
Thank you so much for having me, Matt and Colette. I'm very excited to be here.
Jeff, that's just all kind of cool stuff, in my opinion. Just
yeah, it doesn't get much cooler than that.
It's kind of cool. Like, I stalked you a little bit on the internet, and I found out that you have a pasta-themed tarot deck, which made me really excited. And then, like, 2 seconds before we recorded the show, I saw that you worked on immortality, and I had to, like... like clap my hand over my mouth because I was like, oh my God!
Well, thank you so much. Yeah, I had a lot going on this year.
Yeah, that's so great. All right. Well, back it up. Back it up. Tell us, introduce yourself to our listeners and sort of your background and how you got into your love of games and then eventually how it brought you to a career in games.
Yeah, for sure. So Matt, you and I worked together.
We did.
Back in our Mashable days. I worked in media and media production my whole life coming out of undergraduate, where I studied philosophy and had no idea what I was going to do. I wound up really loving the kind of like problem solving on creative projects. That's kind of like the most basic form, I think, of what interested me about production. And I worked in film for like 3 years. I worked for some famously Me Too'd people before shifting over.
Wow.
it was a hoot. Before shifting over to news media, because that got a little closer to my love of technology, which I've always had since I was a little kid. I was the first employee of a company that became Now This News back over a decade now, which is wild. I helped ruin the internet with text on screen video.
You really need a t-shirt that says I helped ruin the internet.
To get media nerdy on you here, but I'm trying to put the timeline together. Were you at Now This before joining Mashable or after?
Yeah.
Which direction?
I was at Now This before. Yeah.
That's right. Okay.
So but I had some incredible experiences there from both a business perspective and a media production perspective, and brought that over to Mashable. I wound up being there for about 3 years. Honestly, probably still to this day, my favorite full-time job that I've had longer than 3 months.
Yeah, it was a time and a place. It was the most fun you could ever have at a job, because it was just a magical moment in media where things were very positive and optimistic, and we had the staff and talent and budget to experiment and do cool shit. And that's what Jeff's job was all day. And it was the coolest you guys did amazing work. And we will never have that time again. Goodbye forever.
It was really a special moment. So, but even during my time at Mashable, I always kind of like made a dive for the game stuff. Like, I famously dressed up as King Boo and ran around E3.
I need photographs if they exist.
There actually is a Mashable YouTube video still available. If you just go to YouTube and type in Mashable King Boo, you can watch me do that.
My God. That's delightful. Yeah.
The best part of it was I got to cut the line at the Nintendo booth and play Smash before it came out, which was cool.
Ooh, very nice.
But yeah, so I always had it, it was always a part of my life. I grew up loving specifically board games. I wasn't allowed to play video games for a long time growing up. That really backfired. For my mom. But afterwards, worked in media. News was never really my passion, though. It was more like the technology and the production end of it. And when I was thinking about, after Mashable, what was I going to do? It was all like social media jobs that I could get that were going to pay really well, but that I just did not want like at all. And that's when I decided I wanted to learn to code. I went to a coding boot camp called Full Stack Academy of Code in Manhattan. I did that actually while I still was at Mashable on nights and weekends.
Familiar. I remember this.
Yeah, it was a bold move. I had never done anything like that, but it really bolstered my confidence ultimately for applying to a master's in game design at the NYU Game Center, where I spent 2 wonderful years studying and where I now teach. Graduated from there in 2019 with that MFA and a ton of debt that I have yet to pay off. Thanks for that. But yeah, ever since then, I've been working.
What about Joe Biden? Come on, what are we doing?
Oh my God! Thank
you. Can we get some of that knocked off?
Pittance, relative to my total.
1% of that NYU tuition knocked right off.
When they talk about like all those people, it helps like drastically. It's not, they're not talking about me, but it's fine. I'm so happy it happened for those people.
Yes, truly. Indeed.
But yes, I've been working in games since then. I did a lot of student work, mostly in, again, analog game design and alternative controllers. I love tinkering around. I still do that on the side.
Oh. And yes. Like alternative, like game controllers, game pads and such. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, like all kinds of stuff. I made a controller out of like a toilet plunger. I just had a lot of fun there. And then when I graduated, I searched for a job for a while. I spent some time in P-Town waiting tables, kicking it. And I wound up, working for Sam Barlow as the first producer and hire at his new studio he would start, which eventually I helped name Drowning a Mermaid Productions, became Half Mermaid Productions. And so I worked on Immortality there for about 2 years.
Amazing.
Before, yeah, thanks.
I have lots of things I want to ask, but I want to save it until you're done.
Sure. Yeah. That was an adventure. I left last September. I worked at a studio, an amazing studio called Glow Up Games in Brooklyn, where I helped ship the Insecure Come Up game, which is a mobile free-to-play game based on HBO's Insecure series. Shipped that late last year. And then got a job, working at the New York Times after doing some freelancing work, some independent design work. I even did some fine artwork that wound up in the Cleveland Institute this past summer. And of course, for the last 2 years, I was also working on this pasta-themed queer Italian-American tarot deck, which I kickstarted. And,
which is, that's just a sentence that people say, I would say 20 times a day. That's just where I come from.
That was a passion project. Thankfully, it kicked off on Kickstarter and got picked up by a division of Penguin Random House and is going to be widely available in a matter of weeks to the general public. So I'm very excited about that as well.
Nice. This is a big couple years here.
Yeah,
a lot of good stuff popping off.
I was also really privileged to be invited to teach at the program that I graduated from. So for the last 4 years, I've also been teaching both undergraduate and master's students in the art of game design at the Game Center.
Oh, wow. That has to feel so like cool and full circle for you.
I've always been interested in teaching, and to have the opportunity to do it on a subject matter that I think is so exciting, where there's so much left to be explored, is an incredible opportunity. I am very grateful for it. And for the new contract that the union organized. That's kind of the medium version.
That love it. We would like to get into the slightly longer version as well. Our audience has questions. We have questions. I would like to talk a little, ask you a little bit about your hands-on like work, like day-to-day game design teaching, and also a little bit about the philosophy of alternate controllers, like as a concept. But Colette, I know you must have burning questions about Immortality.
Oh, yeah,
and many
I do.
Other things.
Are you desperately ready for people to shut the fuck up about Wordle?
No, absolutely not.
I'm joking. I'm totally joking. Obviously, we want everyone to love Wordle. My question actually, I will kind of keep this lean because, of course, we do have a lot of questions. It is about Immortality because it was one of the most fascinatingly different games I played this year. I adored it. I was like, I carried my PC, which is in my office, to the living room and plugged it into our television because I had to play it on like a big screen. And it was just
nice.
I loved it. I loved it. So I would love to know like what the perspective was for you of kind of like working on that. How was it? And you know, how did you feel about seeing that come together?
Yeah. So it was a really interesting process. Sam is what I would describe as a like visionary game designer.
He has an extremely strong
idea of what he wants to make. Mm-hmm. And so it was a lot of onboarding into his brain in a lot of ways. Like, yeah, pretty much for the first year, I got a crash course in cinema history in the late 20th century of sort of like auteur artisanship. I had to, you know, I read books on vampires and haunted houses, and I watched movies about possession and, you know, lots of Hitchcock and Nicholas Roeg films, and got to really live in the brain space that he was, you know, preoccupied with for the development process of Immortality. So that was a very, very special experience, because I had never, even though I was always interested in film, I started the film club in high school. I worked in film, right? I never really like studied it formally. Yeah. I never even, for example, I can't believe this is true, but like I had never sat down with a director and been like, I'm going to watch all your movies and think about what that means about you as a director, as a person. And So to have the opportunity to do that was incredible. And I'm so grateful for that. I have a new favorite movie on Letterboxd because of that process. You know, I just had a great time going through all of this incredible information and learning so much about the inspiration behind this game. So that was a huge part of it. COVID was another huge part of it. I'm not gonna lie. We basically started a studio, moved into a small shared office space in Gowanus, Brooklyn, and 8 weeks later, it was COVID. 12 weeks later.
Oh my God.
So yeah, it was very, very disruptive. And you could imagine trying to make a game where the majority of the production is like essentially filming three movies. There were so many, you know, just like concerns about, is this even going to be possible ever? You know, so that was a huge, you know, that's my COVID job experience, honestly.
Wow.
Mortality. Even more so than, you know, we all read about how disruptive it was to game development, but many studios eventually slowly figured out like, oh, I'm just passing this, you know, I'll pass my code to you, you'll pass it to me, we'll run a test, whatever. We're making virtual environments remotely, which sounds very hard, but we make media remotely also. But like, we couldn't film people for a year and a half, basically. So yeah, this particular game, and actually, Jeff, walk it back a smidge, because we're familiar with Immortality. Obviously, Colette's played it, but give us the TLDR on the concept. It's a very unique game.
Yes. So the concept of Immortality, first of all, Immortality is what we call a full motion video game. An FMV game is a very cool history to that whole genre. But it means that it's mostly made up of like actual live action video clips. So it's not like many other video games that you might play out there. The concept is that there was this actress named Marissa Marcel who was supposed to be kind of like the next It Girl in Hollywood coming up in the late 60s and early 70s. And the three movies that she made all got lost, kind of in like a sort of dark Hollywood legend. And Immortality is gameplay-wise styled after a moviola, which is like an old movie editing device. And you, as the player, are going through the found reels of these unfinished three films as you piece together the story of Marissa Marcel, the story of the movies themselves, and then perhaps another layer if you look deep enough. So,
oh God, yeah. So good. I'm not going to spoil absolutely anything, but all I can say is that moment where you first see something more, like I think I literally was like, oh, out loud in my living room. It's wonderful and so unusual. And if you're fascinated by the idea of game being just unlike anything you've ever played before, you should play this game. I can't remember if I mentioned it on the podcast. I think I did when I was playing. I think we did cover it.
But you know what? I don't know that we covered it in depth. So I'm glad Jeff is here to talk more about it, because maybe you had been dabbling, but then you did not go. We did not go deep on it, I don't think.
No, so, I didn't. And I, even if I had, like, I wouldn't have wanted to have talked about it in deep detail, because I just would have felt. I would never want to spoil this particular kind of story.
All over the place. Yeah.
Never. Yep. Literally never. Yep. So, yeah, no. But anyway, yeah. So thank you for helping to create something that is incredibly unique. I really appreciate that.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, it's so cool. Like, that's really the big first game that I'm a producer on. And, you know, the first review it had was like a 10 out of 10 in Edge Magazine. I was just like, what is going on?
Oh, yeah, it's really cool. It's fantastic. It's really cool. But that's really just like one small thing in like a long line of really interesting things you've done.
Thank you.
We want to talk about the times. I want to circle back to the controller stuff. It's more of a philosophical question, which is apt since that is your educational background. But you know, I think about this often, and that is the controller, the gamepad has sort of become a lingua franca sort of for game input, obviously. Like, used to be disparate. We used to have weird trackballs and joysticks and mice and whatever. And now we have all, as a society, agreed that there's face buttons, there's shoulder buttons, and now we can make games for all different platforms because we have mostly agreed on how a controller works. And then I'm also thinking about, you know, we talk a lot about the Steam Deck and ports to Switch, and like, I'm playing Factorio and Civilization and all these very granular mouse and keyboard games with a gamepad, and I fucking love it. I love playing with a gamepad. Nice. I don't like sitting in front of my computer. And so all this amazing adaptation is going into this form factor. And then I think, like, well, when will there ever be another better adaptation of this input device? And then you start to see things, like novelty or whatever devices, like the Playdate, which has a crank, and like, yeah, cranking makes total sense in a video game, but like, you're not going to build an entire game library, you know, like a, you know, Nintendo is not going to put a crank on their next Switch or whatever, you know. So all that, what I'm saying is a philosophical question for you, Jeff, which is like, what have you designed, and does it inform, like, maybe the input of 10 years from now will be this or that? We were not thinking, you know, far enough into the future. Does any of that make sense? I'm babbling.
Yeah, here. No, I think it's an excellent question. And to me, it really comes down to the idea of accessibility and innovation, maybe. I would couple it on both sides. On the one side, this sort of decision that you say we've kind of made as a society that we have a standard controller idea of what a controller is really great for in an accessibility standpoint, in the sense that anyone can kind of make games and like be confident that someone will know how to play them, right?
Yes.
You can plug a Microsoft, you know, controller into your computer and create something in Unity, you know, for very low cost that is going to be using the same interface as, you know, God of War is using, right? Like, that is cool. I like that. That's awesome. But on the other hand, it's also can be really, really limiting, right? Like, we are quite literally deciding to limit the ways that we input, right, signals to a game to this extremely, you know, homogeneous form factor. And that's from an artistic perspective. You know, I come at game design very much from like a fine art perspective, you know, teaching at an art school. Like, that's like, you know, a fundamental, like, what are we doing, right? It's very easy to pull that out as being a huge assumption that we're constantly
because you
making.
Can make your game, you can make the physics of your game whatever you want. You can make the puzzles go nuts. You can make the art style photorealistic or super abstract. You have limitless control over what your game looks and sounds and feels like, except for the input. more or less in
and
the current
tunneling
ecosystem
into this very, very standardized thing. Yeah. So I loved exploring all control as a student, and I love encouraging my current students to explore all controllers because it is freeing when it comes to the idea of what a game can be and what kind of experience you can give someone as a player. And it's really, really important to me that the game industry continues to invest and support everything from independent creators to mainstream games that are trying to push the envelope in terms of how we are interacting physically with the games that we're playing. So, you know, I love All Control. All Control, my favorite part of GDC, the yearly game developer conference in San Francisco that happens every March. There's always a showcase of All Control games, and that's like literally my favorite every year to check out. It's magical. Like, people literally create like magical objects. And I just love that. I really love it as an artist.
I love the hobbyists, the hobbyist space too, which is usually, I perceive it as novelty, but it's like, check out this guy on YouTube playing Breath of the Wild with a treadmill. And it's like, whoa, but like, no one actually wants to do that, but like, it's fucking cool. You know what I mean? And so innovation hopefully comes out of those, that melting pot or whatever you might call it of ideas.
Absolutely. Perhaps. And it's also, I think, really important, especially if you're in a city that has access to spaces that support that work. Like, I know here in Brooklyn, we have a space called Wonderville that is an indie arcade and kind of All Control showcase at times. And I always try to go out of my way to, you know, support them and encourage people to continue to develop in this space because it really is quite special.
Love it. Colette, any other questions about, well, I'm sure, I know you have more questions. To take the reins here. Please proceed.
Well, obviously, immortality aside, since I got to fangirl about that for a second, I want to know more about, you know, like what it is like now with New York Times and what you're doing there. I mean, of course, I know like, oh, cool, Jeff works with Wordle. But like beyond that, I don't know what the bigger picture looks like. And I'd like to know.
Yeah, I actually don't think a lot of people know.
That's what I was thinking. If I don't know, they might not know.
Absolutely. I mean, normally people think of the New York Times, you think of, you know, like prestige level news, but we have been making crossword puzzles for decades, right?
So that people love.
So it's always been
like iconic. It's institutional. But I remember when the acquisition of Wordle happened and there was some tweet that was like, the New York Times is now a game developer. And it's like, yes.
I mean, okay.
But also, you know, look, Jeff, we brought you on the show. Here's the real question, okay? All right, let's put all this other stuff aside. If Will Shorts were to, like, have an unfortunate accident, okay?
Oh, my God.
And he's like, are you next in line become the puzzle master?
Absolutely not.
No, okay.
Not even remotely close. So the New York Times, it's like, you know, in many ways how like journalism is separate from, you know, maybe like the product or the business side of things. The games team is kind of set up similarly in terms of editorial being like quite separate from the majority of folks like working to make sure the game functions. So there is a beautiful and wonderful editorial team on the New York Times games team, but I am not on it. So I would definitely not be anywhere in that line of succession. You probably have a better chance.
I do like envisioning the New York Times games department as some sort of Game of Thrones political, you know, whatever. So what do you do? What are you doing day to day over there?
So day to day, I am the producer for two squads on the games team. One is called the Gameplay Squad and one is called the Games Home Squad. And we are responsible for essentially coming up with new ways for people to engage and dive into the world of New York Times games. So as I was saying, like, even though we've been making crossword puzzles for decades, it's really only been about the last 3 years that like the games team at the New York Times has been going full throttle to try to like create a games product. We've even had like the games, the New York Times crossword app on iOS, like far longer than there has ever been a games team. So things have really been shifting in the last few years to think of what we offer in games as going beyond just a crossword, maybe going beyond just your daily Wordle habit. Like, can we really be the premier digital puzzle creators out there? That's what we're going for, you know? So it's not just about coming in and doing the crossword anymore. We want you to maybe start your day with Wordle, you know, go for the crossword when you grab that time, but also like dip into Spelling Bee, maybe check out a visual puzzle like Vertex, or, you know, bend your brain in a new way with Letterboxd or what have you, right? Like, we're trying to build this suite of puzzle games for our users that they can engage with on a daily basis, and that they can do so on a number of surfaces that you can access the Times at. And everything from mobile web to desktop web to our apps. One of the most exciting things that we've done in the past few weeks was like introduce what we call the Play tab to the New York Times News app, which is like awesome, right? Like if you just download the New York Times, the New York Times app, like if you go into the app store and just download the New York Times, there's now a Play tab right at the bottom of your screen that really gets you into this ecosystem of games. So that's incredibly exciting. And we really think of it as a huge asset to subscribers.
Exactly. And you know, not to get all businessy about it, but like, first and foremost, like, you, the listener, anyone who cares about journalism, like, you should pay for news. You should subscribe to the New York Times or your local paper. Like, you should subscribe to things, full stop. And there are obviously lots of reasons for that. But, you know, we could talk media forever, but it's like, if something happens in Ukraine, like, the New York Times will report it boots on the ground primary source. But like, I can get that news from Reddit later. You know what I mean? Like, I will get that information. But from a business perspective of like, if games that are essential to my gaming lifestyle are in a subscription model, that is an added benefit. That's like, hey, come for the news, stay for the games. And Colette and I have talked about this a lot. Netflix is getting into the game space because they're not competing with Disney Plus. They're competing with Fortnite. They're competing with mobile games. So they're also saying, hey, you can get these awesome, mostly mobile games as part of your subscription. Just log in. And it's a suite of attention grabbing things, for lack of a better word. It's news, it's entertainment, it's games, it's everything.
I had a cool opportunity to negotiate the Netflix deal for Immortality when that was like still kind of under wraps.
Oh, that's right. I forgot.
So it's not out yet. That was really exciting to see what they're doing. And I agree with you, Matt. Obviously, like, subscribing is a really important way to support, you know, media that we believe in. I'm so grateful, for example, that like I get the opportunity to give to Patreon, to podcasts that I listen to and really care about. Like, I'm excited about that kind of stuff. Yeah, and I think that Times, like, it also goes both ways, right? Like, you come for the games and then you wind up, you know, staying for the news, right? Like, which could be an amazing way for us to reach an entirely new audience. You know, the New York Times has had plenty of time to build its reputation. So anything we can do to expand that or change it in people's minds is a really exciting opportunity.
Okay. Briefly on this topic before we branch out a bit, but Wordle was an acquisition, of course. It was a free web app, and now it is part of the New York Times, of course. We all know that, but it remains outside the paywall, I think. Is that correct?
Yes, definitely. I mean, that is 100% something we did not want to put Wordle behind a paywall.
It's such a phenomenon. It's such a cultural moment. And so obviously you're not putting it behind, but it's sort of a interesting hybrid, like, okay, well, we're bundling games with subscription and subscription matters, but here's a a major cultural phenomenon that can, I mean, one day, I don't know, you know, and we don't have to get into that, but like for now, it's too important to go behind the paywall. So like, how does Wordle fit into the whole like ecosystem subscription, like you were saying just before, like getting people into and out of other products?
Yeah, well, obviously, I mean, Wordle was a massive just like audience that we were able to have access to all of a sudden. So I think, you know, just being able to expose a lot more people to the fact that the New York Times cares about games, makes them by hand every day, you know, that's just like a great opportunity to talk to talk to folks, right? Regardless of how they're coming in. You know, it's a really incredible platform from which we can introduce ourselves as a brand of games. So that was a humongous opportunity for sure. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, I don't want to speak in absolutes. Things can always change, but I always imagine you should, you know, be able to come into the New York Times and like always play something, right? Even if you're not a subscriber, have some sort of experience that will entice you and, you know, make you feel rewarded and maybe even make you feel like you're, you know, juicing up your brain a little bit. We love to challenge you in that way, right? So, you know, I don't think that's going to go away, but Wordle really gave us a huge opportunity to introduce the rest of what we do to a lot more people. Like, for example, you know, when you finish Wordle now, there's like a lot of folks get a little thing that's like, try out Spelling Bee, right? Like, mm-hmm. not everyone does that, obviously, but like, people don't even know about Spelling Bee, you know, a right. large majority, you know, I would think of the Wordle audience when they first came in, probably had no idea. And like, it's a really cool and fun game. And if you're into Wordle, chances are you might actually be into Spelling Bee. It's another word puzzle. Like, it's in the realm of possibility that that is a value add for you. Absolutely. So we're not all right. shy about sharing it, you know.
Hear me out. Wordle, free to play, but you put a little battle pass in there. And oh, then as you get your words, you get hats and you get skins. Come on. Let's do this.
Get out of my brain.
10%. I'll take 10%. You know, it's a great idea, right?
One thought that I did have though, like when, you know, we talked about this and Matt said, hey, I'd love to bring Jeff on the show. And I was like, oh, let me go look at Jeff. And so I looked at what you were doing and I was like, so cool. And then I was like, you know, what's cool to me about this is that, you know, we sit here talking about video games and I kind of thought that what you were doing for the New York Times was kind of like, I mean, this is very broad. I'm sure many nerds also take, you know, also participate in the New York Times games, but like non-nerds that are like, I'm going to play games, you know, and it's like, oh, it's on the New York Times, so it's cool. And like some of these people are people that would like sneer at video games, not really knowing that they're, I feel like what they're enjoying in a crossword or in Wordle is not anywhere. It's not quite as different as they might think what video game people are playing. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. I mean, I think one of the tales that we've told probably now for over 10 years is that most people who play games don't actually think of themselves as gamers, right? It's
right?
kind of it's a fundamental fact. Like the majority of people who play games don't think they do in a really weird way, right?
If it's on a phone or like on a computer, they don't. That reminds me of like when Farmville was big on Facebook, but those
absolutely.
People didn't think they were gamers. And I was like, oh, you are.
But and we talked about this here. I despise the word gamer because it has such a gross stigma about it of like, oh, a game. And you just imagine
thanks gamer
in
game.
The basement. Exactly.
Right? Yep. Thank you.
And so I like to get rid of that word and say things like, I love games. I am a game enthusiast. Like whatever. You like game. You
like
crossword. I like. Yeah. You like puzzles. I like Stardew Valley. We both like game. You know.
Absolutely. I think the pandemic kind of helped a little bit with that. I think I like there were people playing like Animal Crossing that I wouldn't have guessed in a million years. Mm-hmm. You know, things like that. But that's, you know, to me, it's kind of funny because, you know, I've studied this stuff. Like, to me, that argument is so gone and done. Like, it's so ingrained in me that everyone's a gamer, even if they don't think so, that sometimes I forget that that's, you know, still a thing. For sure. It comes up with the marketing department all the time.
Yeah. I mean, like, if you want to get down to human psychology and evolution, it's like games are stories. Games are experiences with stakes that our ancestors probably did around the campfire. And now we just do them on NewYorkTimes.com or on Steam or whatever we do.
Actually, we would say games are pre-human. Dogs play games. We've been playing games before we've even been a species.
Wow.
Which is really cool to think about, but also wild to think that it wasn't really until the last few decades that we've studied them in any sort of actual way.
Yeah,
very that's bizarre. A great point. But you know, I think part of that is wrapped up a little bit with the fact that, like, you can be quote unquote bad at games. Like, you can feel like you are not good at them. And it's hard to feel that way about, like, a movie or a book.
That's a really good point. Watching the movie is passive unless you discuss it, you know, in a public forum. But games are active.
Yeah. At games, like other interactive forms of art, ask you to be an author in the experience in a way that linear media does not. So there's an element of, like, shame.
I think that is absolutely right. And then I wonder if a lot of that comes from the baggage of what games have been for, at least I'll say just video games, for the last 40 years. Because when you look back at the history of video games, it's like, what if you had tennis, but on your TV? And it's like scoring and high scores and beating and winning and competition. And I think that baggage is like, oh, no, that's not for me. I don't do that. But now we have games that are, I mean, and perhaps Colette's going to talk about them, of like move, you know, unpacking, you know, like move this picture frame into the right place and feel good about it. That's a video game. And we didn't know we loved that until 2021 or whatever, you know. So, yeah, I think the medium has evolved in order to evolve this study quite a bit in the last 10, 20 years for sure.
Yeah. I mean, and that's one of the most important, like the most, excuse me, that's one of the most exciting parts of teaching, especially my undergraduate students, because these are kids who are literally growing up. Like, I don't know about you, but I grew up expressing myself writing like bad poetry on LiveJournal.
Same.
Like, literally, like I was expressing myself, like who knows what I was doing? Like, these are kids who are like in school and we are telling them, please express yourself by making a game in the next 3 weeks. Like, who's ever been asked that? You know what I mean?
Can, like, you imagine if we had that opportunity?
It's wild. It's really wild.
Like, instead of, I mean, no offense to LiveJournal, it was a glorious experience, but still, like, wow. Just wow.
Yeah. It's really cool.
I have to insert one of our listener questions. It's perfect for this part in the conversation. Docky from our Discord asks, and Docky is in game development as well. So Docky knows what, you know, gets in the weeds with us on this stuff. But Docky asks, how do you balance allowing design students to make their own mistakes versus safeguarding them from a ruined project? I feel like that question is like exactly what you were about to talk about.
Literally did that today. That's a humongous part of my job. So, you know, I think this goes to actually like art school more generally, even like I cannot tell you what to make. I can't even really tell you if what you made is good or bad. I can critique it, but I'm just like one person, right? Like, it doesn't really matter. It's art. So I really try to like give my guidance to the practice, right? And less about the content. It's not really like I want them to make whatever they want to make. If they tell me it's a game, I believe them, right? But there are things that I can teach you that can help you get better at making whatever you want to make. And that's really what I try to focus on. So like even this morning, I'm teaching juniors, right? So this isn't the basics, but you know, I taught them what a spike is, right? Which is like kind of like, and maybe like a research like very broadly speaking, it's like engineering work done at work that engineers do that isn't coding. and a lot of times is like, you can call it a spike. They're researching how to do something. Maybe they come up with like a little one page document of options of how to solve a problem. Mm-hmm. I combined that, you know, definition with like this idea of time boxing, which is like a project management skill that like where you decide you're only going to spend a certain amount of time on a task. And I'm like, you can time box a sprint to figure out that something you don't know how to do technically is either possible or not. And then you can stop working on it and do something else if it's not working, right? Like just these like little tips that are not about what it is that they are making, but how they make it and their practice as designers. That's really what I focus on. And you know, another humongous part of it is collaboration. Collaboration and communication. I can't tell you, especially for BFA students, how much my teaching is focused around working around with other people in a collaborative way. It's really hard to learn that and to teach it.
Yep. It's super tactical. You know, you can teach art, of course, but like, it sounds like art is art. You're letting the kids make the art they want to make, and you're giving them the tools and resources and structures to be successful at making the art that they want to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I encourage them to tell me how to tell them if they've been successful or not. And I do that by saying, please give me a design goal, right? Like, you tell me what you want me to feel, and then I can tell you if I feel it or not. That's like a very simple way to kind of take the subjectivity out of it and say, you know, my goal as a designer is to make someone feel, I don't know, creeped out and nervous, right? I can tell you if I feel creeped out and nervous playing your game, and then you can have five other people play it, and you can look as and see if you're hitting that experience for enough people that you feel satisfied with. You know what I mean? Like, you tell me what success looks like, and I can help you get there, you know? But in terms of the actual content, right, like, it's up to them. It's just my job to kind of to control the scope of their thinking and have them work within the constraints that they have, which is most importantly, time.
That's a note for anyone creative in any creative endeavor. I don't often think of it that way, but like you said, it takes the subjectivity out. It's like, this is a clear goal. We want to be creeped out in this moment, in this part of the book or the movie that you're making or whatever. You can apply this to anything. So I love that. I love that. All right. Fantastic. Colette, any other immediate questions? Otherwise, we could hop to a break. And
I almost feel like if I keep asking questions that we would never get to the part of the show where we talk about what we're playing. So I'm going to just stop.
I was holding myself back for the same reasons. All right. We will return with Jeff Petriello after this brief commercial break.
For every episode of No More Whoppers that you listen to, we will send you a 25-cent coupon for participating Krogers. How many Krogers are participating? None, but you're still getting the coupon.
And it's like 25 cents in 1985 dollars.
Right, so today that's like
28 cents.
No More Whoppers. Take that to the bank and smoke it.
On the HyperX Podcast Network and nomorewhoppers.com.
If you're a shrewd shopper, it's about to be your favorite time of the year. HyperX will be running massive sales for the holiday season. Get up to 50% off some of our most popular products, like the ultra-comfy Cloud 2 headset, the tough, responsive Alloy Origins mechanical keyboard, and the fan-favorite Quadcast USB microphone. Sales will be going on at all major e-tailers, but be sure to head to HyperX.com and sign up for the newsletter to get the scoop on the biggest deals. Happy holidays from HyperX.
We have returned. Jeff is here, game designer, game teacher, game design teacher at NYU. We would like to talk about some video games. What do you say?
Vidget.
I'm down.
Yeah.
Do they have to be video games? Is my question.
Nope. I think that you should talk about whatever games you're playing, especially if it's Gloomhaven.
Oh, stop. Literally get out. Get out of my head.
No, I'm sorry. It's just, you know, I've lived and worked on the internet now for, I don't know, almost 30 years. And like, I can't help it. I'm just like, oh my God, look how cool this is. Oh my God, he has this cool thing. Oh my God. And then I was like, he likes board games. Cool. I also like board games and have yet to play Gloomhaven, which is just silly because I like spooky things.
Oh my God. Well, Gloomhaven is not very spooky.
It's not really? You don't think so? No. Okay. I always kind of assumed from the outside that it was.
Yeah, now that I think about it, Gloomhaven kind of, like, if you think of the card game Gloom, it's like explicitly spooky.
Oh
themed.
My God. I love that game so much, and I haven't played it in so long.
But
I have to tell Matt about
spooky.
That separately. It's not. No. So I'm just thinking of it from like what the box looks like when I go to the game store. But that's a favorite of yours, yes?
Gloomhaven, I think it's the game I've spent the most time playing ever.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I've put hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of hours into Gloomhaven.
I'm extremely gloom curious, and I would
like
to know.
This is a great time to be gloom curious, because what I was going to bring up is that they've started delivering Frosthaven. People are receiving it as we speak. And
oh, this is the expansion?
No, it is not an expansion. It is a sequel that is somehow longer than the original.
And heavier. Well, the first box was like 50 pounds or something, because there's so many cards and miniatures and something.
So the friends that I play with, we can't even tell you. Like this, we joke about, like, when we're going to when we're like at the club, sometimes we just like pretend we're in Gloomhaven. Like, it's that level. So like, we're just like, we are so excited to waste so much of our mid 30s devoted.
Not wasting if you're in joy. So I have a question. Have you ever played the Gloomhaven game on Steam? And if you haven't, do you think, if you have, do you think that it's worth playing, or do you think that just play the board game?
I haven't. I am so, like, the part of Gloomhaven that I love the most is yelling at my friends. So like,
that's awesome.
That is just like, you know, it just didn't have the appeal. I'm sure it's a really interesting game. Like, mechanically speaking, Gloomhaven is very innovative from a tabletop game perspective. Mm-hmm. But from a video game perspective, I don't know. It never appealed to me to jump on there and
because I'm so curious, do we know if the video game version is like, has parity mechanically with the board game, or is it different or limited in some way? Okay.
I think it
does. I'm looking at it on Steam because when I wanted to visually look at Gloomhaven while we were talking, and I was like, oh, this is cool. There is a game version of it. But then I kind of paused and I thought about like that, you know, tactile experience of the games that I have versus like, you know, playing on a screen. And not that it wouldn't be good as a digital game, but I was like, I probably would prefer to have the board game experience if I was going to try it.
Yeah, I think kind of what tipped me towards that decision was I also recently played a game called Descent, which is another big box
I've seen that in the store.
Based legacy board game, and I played it, and it has one of the innovations is that it's, you cannot play it without the app. And I'm a very app friendly tabletop gamer. Like, I modded my Gloomhaven experience to rely heavily on apps. I love them. I thank them greatly for it. But Descent, the story, the narrative is entirely on the iPad, basically. I mean, cards have some text on them, but like, you're getting the whole story with like voice actors and like animation and all of that in this iPad. And ultimately, like, we were a bunch of friends like watching a show on an iPad, and I felt that was taking away from what I really loved about the Gloomhaven experience with the iPad, which was like still really interactive, but like the story was emerging out of us. And that was really important to me. So I enjoyed Descent, and I think there's a lot of innovation. I'm not saying it's impossible, you know, or I wouldn't play a game that had its narrative on a digital component with also a tabletop component. I think that sounds really cool. But yeah, it just, like, in contrast, which I inevitably do anytime I play a game that's even remotely like Gloomhaven, It just didn't do it for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Totally get that. Well, since clearly you enjoy indie board games, I'm kind of curious what other stuff you really, really like in that sphere.
Oh, yeah. Like in the same vibe as Gloomhaven or like just
generally?
Doesn't
have to be in the same vibe, but just kind of like in that indie board game world. I have quite a stack in the living room. So, of course, I'm ooh, will I know any of them?
Absolutely. I mean, I was just playing Azul last week as I moved in with some friends that came over.
I need
Azul
to get
Summer
that one.
Pavilion specifically. Mm-hmm. That game's great. My eternal housewarming gift, and like literally I carry it around with me everywhere I go, is Quix. If you haven't played Quix, it is $8.
No, I've never even heard of it.
Amazon. It's a roll and write. It is just like everyone loves it. That is an incredible game. I carry that Quix. Around all the time.
Okay, yeah, cool.
Quixx.
Okay.
And then I will say, like, what's really inspired me as an artist in the tabletop space recently, like, it's actually not recent, it's probably 5 or 6 years old now, but there's a tabletop role-playing game called the Quiet Year by Avery Alder that is incredible mechanically. Cool. It's a tabletop role-playing game where you take turns, every player has a turn, but you're always role-playing the entire community that you are a part of. And it's a map making game. I constantly think about it when I'm designing.
Really? That's
it's
cool.
So powerful.
I'm pulling it up now. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Matt, that kind of sounds like it might be what we call a mad ass game.
Oh,
here.
Yeah. I mean, map making, cartography. Yeah. Tell me more.
Oh, yeah. There you go. It's absolutely amazing.
When something is extremely mad, it's a mad ass game. And when it's extremely Colette, it's a Colette ass game.
I love it.
Good
yeah,
stuff.
So that's been incredibly inspirational for sure. And then, of course, like everyone else, I mean, I was playing Wingspan for all of 2020.
That's a beautiful game.
Yeah.
I have not bought any new board games in quite a while. Like, we keep buying, my husband and I keep buying games, and we're like, oh my God, it looks so cool. And then we get home and we're like, it's four players and there's two of us.
Aww.
And we have friends, but like, we don't, like, you know, we're like little, like, you know, we hang out at home together a lot. So we're like, man, we need to get more really good two-player like things that we can just bust out. So I'll have to ask you about that off the podcast.
Yeah, please.
And
it's hard,
I don't know,
to organize, but worth it. I always find
that's what I was going to say of like, if you have a crew of people who are as devoted as you are, then that is a wonderful thing.
Definitely.
We have, a handful of lovely friends, but busting out Gloomhaven with any of them sounds terrifying. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's
unless,
a different
unless they're
level.
Really into it. It's
you need,
next
you need commitment. You need commitment.
Yeah.
But the other thing is you can play Gloomhaven by yourself if you're that hardcore.
Yeah.
There's always that option.
In a nutshell, because I've been tempted to buy the Steam version and just kind of tinker with it. You know, obviously not as good, but like, does it just pan out as like a really good RPG, basically? So single player?
I will say that the story is not Gloomhaven's strength.
Mm. Ah.
Yes. I will say the mechanical complexity, the variety of the scenarios, the incredible innovations in terms of legacy board game play, meaning games that change over time when you play them, that is really where the joy of the game came for me. So
yep,
I would say no.
Awesome.
Excellent. All right. What do you say we take another quick break and we'll come back? Oh, wait, before we go, we have to, maybe we'll roll a d20 here. Who's going to go next? Colette or me? I usually wrap up the show, but maybe.
Yeah,
Colette,
I can go next.
Wanna,
I don't mind.
You jump in?
We don't need to. We can roll our invisible d20.
All right,
it landed
let's
on
roll,
me.
And it landed on you. And we will come back with Colette's current obsessions when we return.
Hi, it's me, Jeremy Parrish, co-host of the Retronauts podcast, the only video game history podcast that's been around so long, it's also a part of video game history. Every week, one of the motley rabble who hosts this show leads a deep dive into the past, whether it's to break down a classic franchise, learn more about a timeless game from its creator, or just wallow in nostalgia. Relive history with Retronauts here on the HyperX Podcast Network.
Hey there, friends. It's Matt. I'm here to tell you that it's that time of year again, and I don't care what you say. There's nothing I can do about time. Holiday shopping time, and if you want to get ahead of the curve, HyperX will be running big sales for the holiday season. That's up to 50% off, 50, of the big product lines, including the ultra comfy Cloud 2 headset, the Alloy Origins mechanical keyboard, if you're into those fancy keyboards, and the fan favorite, the Quadcast USB microphone, if you're recording podcasts. That's up to 50% off on some gifts for the gaming enthusiast or the podcaster or the technology enthusiast in your life. And maybe throw something in the cart for yourself. Any major retailer or e-tailer where you typically get your favorite gear will have these sales. And you can also head over to HyperX.com and sign up for the newsletter so you can be alerted for the biggest deals right away. Happy holidays from us, and thank you to HyperX for supporting the show. We are back, and last week we were taking a peek at all the Nindies that were announced in, not announced, but sort of trailers and reveals, and it's out now. And there were quite a few things that we were like, yep, put it on the list. And you had promised me and our listeners that you were going to grab some of these beautiful creatures. Have you made good?
I have partially succeeded. So I have played one game I said I was going to play. I have downloaded one game I said I was going to play, but not picked it up yet. And I have continued to play the game that I have now been playing for weeks, which is still Coral Island.
Yes.
And I'm still enjoying it. And it's still like a prettier, like, you know, I mean, it's I don't want to even say prettier Stardew. It's different. But I mean, you know, if you love the beats of Stardew, you will definitely love this game, I think. Also, I think I also mentioned that it is was made by, I believe, an Indonesian design team. I think I'm right. I have to go double check and look. But I just think it's really inclusive, really beautiful, and just so nice to see, you know, more people making games from countries that I'm not used to seeing games come out of. So I've been really enjoying, you know, more of that. But I'm not going to go on about that game because I don't think there's a lot new for me to report. Like, you know, I'm farming and I'm mining and, you know, that kind of shit. It's a nice groove. But I think the game that I've been like, you know, this is really, really cool that I've broken out this week has been The Chant, which I think I did mention it last week.
You
right?
were hyping it up and you were very excited to dive in.
Yeah. So I was like, you know, I'm just in the mood. It seems like a great game to play at night. So like I downloaded it in the evening and played it like, you know, in the dark in my living room. And it's really interesting because I read a lot of reviews beforehand. So just as a quick, in case people don't know what this is about, the premise for this game, I was like, wow, why hasn't anybody ever done this before? It's a person, a woman who has had a traumatic event in her life. Someone has died. And so a friend has talked her into going into like going on a spiritual retreat. And, you know, she gets there and it's not, it's not cool.
Yeah.
It's not good. I mean, I could go on.
The cult,
it's a little like a midsummer.
Adjacent.
It's like a midsummer plot.
I mean, I don't think it's quite as unusual as what's happening in Midsummer yet. So but I don't know because I'm not far enough in. I'm probably like 5 hours in. I would say it leans a little more towards Lovecraftian, at least so far. But like, I was like, okay, this is clearly going to be a survival horror game. And, you know, Jeff, since you're our guest, I'll say I'm a massive survival horror fan. Just love it. Love horror in all forms. So I was like, okay, like I'm going to play this. And the reviews I read were like, you know, this is really, it's from an indie studio. And they were like, you know, it's a double A game. It's not a triple A game, meaning, you know, you can see that in the budget. So when I first watched the trailer, I was like, interesting, because everything looks really gorgeous. But my one call out was the faces don't look quite as good as kind of what I'm used to in games right now. And Matt and I talked about that a little bit back and forth. But then I started playing the game and I realized that like that was a criticism that could have really been easily leveled at it from outside just from watching the trailer. But actually playing the game, I was like, for a studio that's never made a game before, like this is incredible. Like, you know,
so cool.
And then, yeah, like some people were like, oh, the storytelling, this is all on Steam, the reviews, the storytelling is really like wooden. It's not. It's totally not. The acting is pretty good. Like, I mean, I don't know what their budget was, but I was like, well, okay, this is pretty cool. I don't know how it's going to end. I have heard it's not long. I have heard that it's, I think, like 8 hours long or something.
I love that.
Mm-hmm. I don't have an issue with that. Thank you. Because, like, look, when I was in my 20s, I could play 40, 50, 60 hours on a game. And now in my current lifestyle, 8 hours is perfect for me. Like,
agree.
It just is. Like, I don't think a game has to be a certain length. You know, I just think it's interesting because if you grew up through like the RPG, you know, the big thick RPG days, you know, Square Soft's early RPG days, you're like, oh, well, you know, it's worth $60 if it's 80 hours long.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, you know, 30 hours of that was side quests that didn't need to happen because they were trying to make the game longer. I think it's worth it to pay, you know, that money for a shorter experience. Like, I don't know. There's a lot of like art quibbles in there that I could go on about, but I'm not going to, you know.
I hope, circling back to the start of our conversation, that the subscription models, I hope, mm-hmm. enable mm-hmm. more of that type of development.
Right. Yeah, I do too. Because I just think it's not fair, you know, for the games to be, you know, to be shit on just because they're, oh, it's only 8 hours long. Well, you paid $40 for it, you know? Like, these people probably worked on this for years. Like, anyway, not going to rant. But, so yeah, as far as I have gotten, I have really enjoyed it. I've played, I would say, I thought maybe 5 hours, but it's probably more like 3 if I really think about it. But it's a bit different from anything else that I've really played, but it has kind of like a very classic, like, Resident Evil kind of like survival horror-ishness about it. Like, it's hard to explain exactly what that is because it doesn't take place in a mansion or anything, but like I was playing it and I was like, oh yeah, this is that like survival horror-ish groove and I like the way it feels, you know. But I've really never played a survival horror game that like touched any part of like cosmic horror, so that was like really cool to me. And so, you know, I don't know if it will, you know, end as well as it's begun, but I mean, it's just been really fascinating to me. There's a really haunting scene where you're like meditating with the group for the first time and like some audio shit goes on and you're just like, oh my god, like what cool. is this? It's really scary and it's great. So I really appreciated it, and I just felt like even though it was familiar in some ways, it was also really fresh in others. So I'm hoping to actually have time to play it tonight because I've been looking forward to some time with it. And then the only thing I didn't play this that I promised I was going to play last week was A Little to the Left, which mm-hmm. is like that delicious groove of it's basically an arranging game. It's like, oh, things are in this position. Please move
what?
Them. Yes.
Oh my God. And I need to check that out.
Yes, you should. I know it's on Switch, but I think it's probably on some other platforms too. I don't know if it's on phones. It might be. Actually, wait, no, I think I played the demo on my iPad, so maybe.
Oh, okay.
It could be. But it calls itself a cozy puzzle game that basically has you like it's the art is beautiful and it's like, oh, here's all this stuff. You need to like figure out where to put it. And earlier in the year, there was a game called Unpacking that I absolutely adored.
Fabulous.
Where you went through these. Did you play it?
Oh yeah, I voted for it.
Okay.
For Game of the Year for Indiecade.
Oh, okay, good. I'm glad I didn't try to explain it to you. Well, I'll do a quick explain in case someone's listening that's never heard of it. It's a beautiful chapter by chapter game of your protagonist, your main character, who is going through different stages of their life. And you get to kind of help them unpack their apartment or home in each of those stages. And the story is elegant and simple and beautiful. And I ranted to Matt about the groove of what it felt like to play Unpacking. I finished Unpacking and I literally went to the credits and started playing it again. Like,
yeah, I couldn't.
That's how much I loved it.
Actually, I could believe that you did that, but it was the speed and ferocity with which you devoured and then re-devoured that game was like, whoa.
That's
and
cool.
Like, it was popping off. So like, I played it and loved it. I got my daughter into it. She absolutely devoured it as well. And we are fascinated by this very unique game that came out of nowhere, that almost created its own genre unto itself. And now here we are with this next game a little to the left, you know, unrelated studio, not the same, you know, it's not a sequel or anything, but like, how often do you get new genres of video games and then
right.
you get different, you know, more in those, in that genre coming out. It's special, very special.
Yeah, I said to Matt, I said, God, please let arranging become like a genre.
Arranging
because
games.
I am a person who loves things to be in their place. And like in my home, in my life, I just like putting things where they belong. So like this scratches that itch. So a little to the left is what we thought when we both saw it. We were like, oh my God, it's not, you know, it's not an unpacking like, but it is absolutely that same kind of let's tidy. It's a tidying
yeah.
game.
It reminds me, first of all, I don't know why I said IndieKid. I meant IGF. It was unpacking was at IGF last year. It was fabulous.
Oh, yeah, okay. Yeah. Okay, that's right.
But it reminds me a little, I played Moving Out last week, which is very mm-hmm. much kind of like an Overcooked-like, you know?
Yes.
It's kind of like chaos, the puzzle. And like, I love that. We're definitely seeing like in this indie space, like people are rapidly innovating. I love that the Switch is such a cool home for it. Like
so
who saw
great.
That happening with Nintendo? Right?
Not me, I love it. It reminds me of like NES era when people were just like, we're just going to build a game about whatever the fuck we want.
Yeah.
So
because
great.
The player base, circling back again, that player base is so massive and diverse. And so you can make games for everyone on this cozy little device that mm-hmm. literally every home in America has, not literally, but you know, that's the recipe for it being the conduit for these maniac, crazy games. Moving Out 2 is coming, if I'm
oh,
not
cool.
mistaken. So keep an eye out.
I didn't
out.
Actually know that. That's
I
awesome.
I believe they are making a sequel. Yes, I think so. Yeah.
Very
we loved
cool.
it. Did you, Jeff, did you play it with like a partner or a roommate or so, or like a friend or whatever?
I played it with
like,
my friend. Yeah, I played it with my friend and I had just actually moved in mere days ago. So it was a thematic pull.
That's perfect. Yeah.
Best/worst time to play this
very
game?
Cathartic.
I don't know.
It was very cathartic to just be throwing everything.
Oh my God. My favorite thing
through the window.
Is when you play the dog and like the dog is running, but like its tongue is hanging out of its mouth and it just looks like it's having the happiest day of its life breaking shit. And I was like,
this is
beautiful.
Fabulous.
I love it. Anyway, I played a lot of games in the past week and it was great. And yeah, very excited to play more. So yeah, Matt, please take the floor. That's it for me.
All right, excellent. So you'll keep us posted on the chat. It sounds like you will be wrapping
yeah.
it up, you know, plowing through it by next week. And then if you get into a little to the left, I'm relying on you. I'm waiting for your review score that one.
I was kind of waiting for the vibe, right? Like
totally.
I was like, ooh, I'm in the mood for a spooky vibe. Ooh, I'm in the mood for, you know, like a chill vibe. But I mean, I don't think I can resist it much longer, truthfully.
Yeah, right, exactly. I mentioned it to my daughter. I was like, oh, remember that game Unpacking? Like there's another one and you can arrange stuff and there's like a cute cat. She's like, download it now. I'm like, okay, maybe I'll read a review. All right.
I love the stories of Matt's children. Just as an aside, it's really like funny to me because like he'll tell these stories and I'll be like, God, it's so intense. Like I just imagine them like staring you in the face, like saying, do it now, father.
Do it now. Yeah. You know, they went hard on Animal Crossing. My son just loves like any beat 'em up Ninja Turtles fighting. He would play Smash Brothers Ultimate for like if we did not come and intervene and turn off the game, he would go for like 10 straight hours just and he just likes to like make it as easy as possible. It's like him versus like three easy level CPUs and just beats the shit out of him. And that's his idea of a good time. And I get it. He doesn't have a main. He likes to dabble with all the characters. Yeah. And my daughter loves Animal Crossing. She's a huge Harry Potter fanatic now. She's 9 years old. And so Hogwarts Legacy, more footage and gameplay is emerging from this game. And for anyone who's not familiar, it's like 100 years before the story of Harry Potter. So you're playing like Hogwarts wizards and witches in the 1800s, Victorian times, which is just like, how could you do better than that, really?
Just pooping all over the floor.
Right? That's the core mechanic of that game. So she's hyped about that. Anyway, I have one game to talk about, and that is Tactics Ogre Reborn. And I'm going to read the Wikipedia entry for this game series because I was mixed up and confused about the timeline. I'm a huge fan of this series, and I had to go back and look at what the hell was going on. Ogre Battle for the Super Nintendo was my jam back in whatever this was. I'm going to look it up here. 93. Ogre Battle, March of the Black Queen. Super Nintendo. Then they made a sequel to Ogre Battle, which was only released on the Super Famicom in Japan. It never arrived on the Super Nintendo in the US. It skipped Super Nintendo and eventually was ported to the PlayStation. Wait, I want to make sure I'm getting this right. No. Okay. Only in Japan. And then Ogre Battle 64 came out for the Nintendo 64. So I played Ogre Battle and Ogre Battle 64. And there was this tactics game in the middle that I was really never aware of, despite being a huge fan of this series. Then they ported that Japanese game to the PSP, which I also never owned. And what's interesting here is that Tactics Ogre was sort of like, it was very, very influential in the tactics space. And then Final Fantasy Tactics came out a few years later for the PlayStation. That's why I'm confused. This was when Square Enix moved over away from Nintendo and into the PlayStation world and made all their Final Fantasies. Final Fantasy Tactics is a game that is mechanically very similar, that owes its lineage to Tactics Ogre, but was sort of lost in the West. So now, just last week, they have released a remake, remaster. I guess it's a remake because I think they rebuilt the engine and all this stuff. Fancied up the graphics, added spectacular voice acting. I believe they cleaned up a lot of the repetitive 90s grinding mechanics that we are happy to be rid of. Though I have no comparison point because I never played the original. But in a nutshell, this is it's a grand fantasy story, and you are leading like a young army of freedom fighters. It's very Game of Thronesy in that there's a lot of houses and political struggles going on. But I'm immediately grabbed by the story because it's not like the evil empire is bad and we're good and so we're going to beat them. Like, it's way more complicated than that. And within minute one, you're immediately like names and places and history and lore and lords and dukes and who's has allegiance to who. And you're like, I don't know what the fuck anyone's talking about, but I'm fully invested in whatever the hell's going on in this story, which was a really nice, not surprise because people have loved this game and story for many years, but I have been personally subjectively burned by holy shit, now my mind went blank. It's Triangle Strategy and what was the other 2D one? Octopath Traveler.
Yeah,
these games were made for me. I was so excited for both of them and was let down by both of them because the stories were very bland. The characters were lame. The writing was, it was overwrought, overwritten, meaning like I felt myself taking like a red pen to every other line being like, just say it, just say these words and move on because that's all that you need to say here. So while those games mechanically and graphically were excellent, like combat systems and tactical systems, I bounced off of both of them because the stories were so boring. And then I was like, just booting up Tactics Ogre being like, please, please just be good. And like yep. minute one, really gripping and exciting.
So good.
So I'm really happy about that. I'm happy to report that for anyone who is maybe on the fence or maybe was similarly excited or sort of disappointed by Triangle Strategy. Triangle Strategy is made in the image of these games. So that's why
nice.
People were excited about them. I want to allude to like the main thing that I love about this series, which is like sort of nonlinear recruiting mechanics. And by that, I mean, you're on the battlefield, you've got your ragtag team of heroes, and then all of a sudden the enemy has a dragon and you're like, whoa, it'd be awesome to have a dragon on our fucking team. That would rule. And then there are ways, if you get the hit points of the dragon down and you have the right character class in your party and that character is equipped with the right skills and he is positioned at the place where you can recruit or tame the dragon at the right moment, depending on how the battle goes, you can convince other enemy characters to join your side. And those characters that you recruit persist throughout the game. And similarly, I should confirm this, I don't know for sure, but if other games in the series are like this, if you lose those characters, though, they're permanently dead. So it's this epic, very long campaign where it's not like, you know, a Final Fantasy where it's like, and now Locke is in your party and he's a hero, so he's always with you. It's like you can kind of pick and choose who you want and kind of get them in the moment. And then there are very deep like character class customization. So it's like this guy starts out as a warrior, but he can graduate to be a wizard, or he can graduate to be a beast master, which will then allow you to tame other creatures and unlock new skills. So it's like, I'm actually very impressed with how deep the mechanical trees go for a game from 1995 and how rich the story is. Yeah. And then on top of that, the team that you know refreshed the game, it runs beautifully on playing on Switch, and the art direction and the voice especially, like, it's just, you know, if you've played any of these modern sort of final, Fire Emblem Three Houses or whatever, you can just kind of click the button and be like, yes, keep playing the dialogue. And then you just kick back and watch the little movies play out and just listen to them, you know, because it's just sprites, you know, there's nothing to watch, but you can just enjoy the dialogue and the acting. And the acting was so abysmal for Triangle Strategy that it's so nice to just kick back and be like, yeah, what's going to happen? The other thing that also is important to these kinds of games is sort of the story consequences. And so I'm very early in the game, but one example is like, oh, there's this woman on the battlefield and she's being pursued by these enemy troops. And you sort of like, you have your own agenda, but you're like, well, you know, we can't just leave her there. And so she's kicking ass and she's fighting off these troops. And if you win the battle, you kind of regroup with her and she's like, I fought all those guys off. Like, what are you doing? And you have a choice. And I think I chose like, well, we're trying to fight to create our own country or something. I chose like choice A. And she's like, yeah, you're all the same. Fuck you. And then she's like, I'm out of here. And it was like, oh man, like she could have joined us, but I kind of chose the wrong dialogue tree, and now I don't have access to her. And that's like a choice that I need to like live with as the story progresses. And that's, I know these games, that's going to happen multiple times. So like the party that I create, the army that I create by the end of this game is going to be radically different from the army that, you know, Jeff might create if he were to play the game. So all that to say is, like, I'm so thrilled that this is really, really good and it's really, really grabbing me. Like, you have to be a fan of these kind of games to love it, but it's ticking all the right boxes for what this game deserves to be. And so very, very happy with Tactics Ogre Reborn. It's out on everything, but it's a really nice experience on Switch to just kind of cozy up on the couch and play handheld like that.
I love that. It sounds like this is like, I know you really wanted a game to really like click with you, and it sounds like this is doing that.
It is. Yeah. I've been searching for a little while. So I'm bouncing between Rogue Legacy 2, which I still think is fantastic, especially on Switch. And now Tactics Ogre. I was playing last night. Oh, you know what they did? They got rid of random encounters. So I think the previous game was like, oh, you encountered a party in the woods and then you got to like fight them off and grind and you level up. And now it's kind of like, if you're in a place on the map, you can opt to train your troops and do like mock battles where your troops won't die. They will just get stronger. And so you can kind of choose to grind to level up. And I was actually playing last night and I got into the next whatever battle chapter. And I'm like, oh my God, I'm getting my ass handed to me. There's like no way I could defeat this crew. And that reminded me like, oh, right. Okay. I should level up. You know, it's one of those games where it's like, hey, do you like menus? Because there are like 45 menus, like skill trees and equipment. And I, when it's done well, I like, okay, dramatic battle, epic story. And now 45 minutes being like, maybe he should be an ice guy. Should she be a lightning guy and he's an ice guy? I think that's what we're going to do. You know what I mean? Like, that's the game for me. And so highly recommend it.
That's freaking great. I love it.
That's it.
We have that's talked about we games.
Have. We have talked. We have it. Succeeded in talked about game, talking about games. We did it. Jeff, thank you so very much for joining us here. We appreciate your time.
Thank you so much for having me. I really, really enjoyed it. And it was so nice to hear from you,
Yay!
Matt. It's been too long. And such a pleasure to meet you, Colette. Really, same, thank you so much.
Same. I actually am sitting here with tab open for The Quiet Year. And I'm like, I'm very fascinated by this entire concept. So thank you for mentioning it as well as
other
things.
Yeah, we got some good recommendations.
Of course, don't hesitate to reach out to me anytime you want to talk weird stuff to play. I'm not kidding. I love it.
And speaking of reaching out, Jeff, where can people find you on the internet if they would like to chat or follow or see your work?
Yeah, absolutely. I am the Beff. That's Jeff with a B. Pretty much everywhere, and have been since AOL in 1995.
Yes.
So you can find me at livejournal.com/thebev. You can find. Please don't go to that. Oh my God.
Do not go to that.
No, but you can find me on Twitter. Thebev.com has some links to my work. I'm on LinkedIn as Jeff Petriello if you want to connect professionally in the game industry. I'm also in like a million Discords, so just try at the Beff in one of them. Maybe I'll show up.
And speaking of Discord, we appreciate the folks in our listening community. As you know and have heard, we are talking games all day, every day, pretty much, and memes and cooking and animals, pets, pretty much anything you would want to talk about. So hop on into our listening community Discord. It is linked in the show notes every single episode. Get on in there. Tell us what you're playing. We ask you regularly. Colette, the final words are up to you.
Pumpkins. That's
pumpkins.
It. Actually, so I ordered some spicy cookies. This is my final word. I ordered some cookies on DoorDash during the show. And they're going to be here in like 10 minutes. So, that's what I have to share today.
Get goodbye. Living that best life. We will talk at you in 1 week. Jeff Petriello, thank you again for joining us. And we will talk at you in 1 week.
Bye.